21. Paragon Asia. San Francisco and Los Angeles seemed more like different planets than different cities. It wasn't the no-cal, so-cal thing, but something that went down to the roots. Rydell remembered sitting with a beer somewhere years ago, watching the partition ceremonies on CNN, and it hadn't impressed him much even then. But the difference, that was something. A stiff gust of wind threw rain into his face as he was coming down Stockton toward Market. Office girls held their skirts down and laughed. And Rydell felt like laughing, too, though that had passed before he'd crossed Market and started down 4th. This was where he'd met Chevette, where she'd lived. She and Rydell had had their adventure up here, had met in the course of it, and the end of it had taken them to L.A. She hadn't liked L.A., he always told himself, but he knew that really wasn't why it had gone the way it had. They had moved down there, the two of them, while Rydell pursued the mediation of what they'd just gone through together. Cops in Trouble was interested, and Cops in Trouble had been interested in Rydell once before, back in Knoxville. Fresh out of the academy back then, he'd used deadly force on a stimulant abuser who was trying to kill his, the abuser's, girlfriend's children. The girlfriend had subsequently been looking to sue the department, the city, and Rydell, so Cops in Trouble had decided Rydell might warrant a segment, so they'd flown him out to SoCal, where they were based. He'd gotten an agent and everything, but the deal had fallen apart, so he'd taken a job driving armed response for IntenSecure. When he'd managed to get himself fired from that, he wound up going up to NoCal to do temp work, off the record, for the local IntenSecure operation there. That was what had gotten him into the trouble that introduced him to Chevette Washington. So when Rydell turned up back in L.A. with a story to tell and Chevette on his arm, Cops in Trouble had perked right up. They were moving into a phase where they tried to spin individual segments off into series for niche markets, and the demographics people liked it that Rydell was male, not too young, not too educated, and from the South. They also liked it that he wasn't racist. And they really liked it that he was with this really cute alt-dot kind of girl, one who looked like she could crush walnuts between her thighs. Cops in Trouble had installed them in a small, stealth hotel below Sunset, and they had been so happy the first few weeks that Rydell could barely stand to remember it. Whenever they went to bed, it had seemed more like making history than love. The suite was like a little apartment with its own kitchen and a gas fire, and they'd roll around at night on a blanket on the floor in front of the fire, with the windows open and the lights out, blue flame flickering low and LAPD gunships drumming overhead. And every time he'd crawl into her arms, or she'd put her face down next to his, he'd known it was good history, the best, and that everything was going to be just fine. But it hadn't been. Rydell had never thought about his looks much. He looked, he'd thought, okay. Women had seemed to like him well enough, and it had been pointed out to him that he resembled the younger Tommy Lee Jones, Tommy Lee Jones being a 20th-century movie star. And because they told him that, he'd watched a few of the guy's movies and liked them, though the resemblance people saw puzzled him. He guessed he'd started to worry, though, when Cops in Trouble had assigned a skinny blonde intern named Tara Mae Allenby to follow him around, grabbing footage with a shoulder-mounted Steadicam. Tara Mae had chewed gum and fiddled with filters and had generally put Rydell's teeth on edge. He'd known she was feeding live to Cops in Trouble, and he'd started to get the idea they weren't too happy with what was coming through. Tara Mae hadn't helped, explaining to Rydell that the camera added an apparent 20 pounds to anybody's looks, but that, hey, she liked him just the way he was, all beefy and solid. But she'd kept suggesting he try working out more. Why not go with that girlfriend of yours, she'd say. She's so buff it hurts. But Chevette had never seen the inside of a gym in her life. She owed her buffness to her jeans, and a few years she'd spent pounding up and down San Francisco hills, on a competition-grade mountain bike, its frame rolled from epoxy and Japanese construction paper. So now Rydell sighed, coming up on the corner of 4th and Bryant, and on Bryant, turning toward the bridge. The bag on his shoulder was starting to demonstrate its weight, its collusion with gravity. Rydell stopped, sighed again, readjusted the bag, put thoughts of the past out of his mind. Just walk. No trouble at all finding that branch of Lucky Dragon. Couldn't miss it. Smack in what had been the middle of Bryant, dead center as you approached the entrance to the bridge. He hadn't been able to see it coming along Bryant, because it was behind the jumble of old concrete tank traps they'd dropped there after the quake. But once you got past those, there it was. He could see walking up to it that it was a newer model than the one he'd worked in on Sunset. It had fewer corners, so there was less to chip off or need repair. He supposed that designing a Lucky Dragon module was about designing something that would hold up under millions of uncaring and even hostile hands. Ultimately, he thought, you'd wind up with something like a seashell, hard and smooth. The store on Sunset had had a finish that ate graffiti. The gang kids would come and tag it. 20 minutes later, these flat, dark, vaguely crab-like patches of dark blue would come gliding around the corner. Rydell had never understood how they worked, and Duria said they'd been developed in Singapore. They seemed to be embedded a few millimeters down into the surface, which was a sort of non-glossy gel coat affair, but able to move around under there. Smart material, he'd heard that called, and they'd glide up to the tag, whatever artfully abstract scrawl had been sprayed there to declare fealty or mark territory or swear revenge. Durius had been able to read these things and construct a narrative out of them, and start eating it. You couldn't actually see the crab legs move. They just sort of nuzzled in, and gradually the tags started to unravel. Derez, molecules of paint sucked down into the blue of the Lucky Dragon graffiti eaters. And once someone had come with a smart tag, a sort of decal they'd somehow adhered to the wall, although neither Rydell nor Durius had been able to figure how they'd done it without being seen. Maybe, Duria said, they'd shot it from a distance. It was the tag of a gang called the Chupacabras, a fearsome, spiky thing, all black and red, insectoid and menacing, and, Rydell thought, kind of good-looking, exciting-looking. He'd seen it worn as a tattoo in the store. The kids who wore it favored those contacts, the kind gave you pupils like a snake's. When the graffiti eaters came out after it, though, it had moved. They'd edged up to it, and it would sense them and move away. Almost too slow to see it happening, but it moved. Then the graffiti eaters would move again. Durius and Rydell watched it the first night get all the way around to the back of the store. It was starting to work its way back around toward the front when they went off shift. Next shift it was still there, and a couple of standard spray bomb tags as well. The graffiti eaters were locked on the smart tag and not taking care of business. Durius showed it to Mr. Park, who didn't like it that they hadn't told him before. Rydell showed him where they'd logged it in the shift record when they clocked off, which had just pissed Mr. Park off more. About an hour later, two men in white Tyvek coveralls showed up in an unmarked, surgically clean white van and went to work. Rydell would have liked to watch them get the smart tag off, but there was a run of shoplifters that night, and he didn't get to see what they did to it. They didn't use scrapers or solvents, he knew that. They used a notebook and a couple of adhesive probes. Basically, he guessed, they reprogrammed it, messed with its code. And after they left, the graffiti eaters were back out there slurping down the latest Chupacabra iconography. This Lucky Dragon by the bridge was smooth and white as a new china plate, Rydell observed as he came up to it. It looked like a piece of some different dream fallen here. The entrance to the bridge had a weird, unplanned drama to it, and Rydell wondered if there'd been a lot of meetings back in Singapore about whether or not to put this unit here. Lucky Dragon had some units on prime tourist real estate, and Rydell knew that from watching the Global Interactive video column back in L.A. There was one in the mall under Red Square, that fancy K-Dom branch in Berlin, the big-ass one in Piccadilly, London. But putting one here struck him as a strange, or strangely deliberate, move. The bridge was a dodgy place, safe enough, but not tourist-safe. There was a walk-on tourist contingent, sure, and a big one, particularly on this end of the bridge, but no tours, no guides. If you went, you went on your own. Chivette had told him how they repelled evangelicals and the Salvation Army and any other organized entity in no uncertain terms. Rydell figured that, in fact, that was part of the draw of the place, that it was unregulated. Autonomous zone, Durius called that. He'd told Rydell that Sunset Strip had started out as one of those, a place between police jurisdictions, and somehow that had set the DNA of the street, which was why, say, you still got hookers in elf hats there come Christmas. But maybe Lucky Dragon knew something people didn't, he thought. Things could change. His father, for instance, used to swear that Times Square had been a really dangerous place. Rydell made his way through the crowd flowing on and off the bridge and past the Global Interactive Video column, daydreaming as he did that he'd look up and see the Sunset Branch there, with Praise God beaming sunnily at him from out in front. What he got was some skater kid in Seoul shaking his nuts at the camera. He went in, to be immediately stopped by a very large man with a very broad forehead and pale, almost invisible eyebrows. "Your bag," said the security man, who was wearing a pink Lucky Dragon fanny pack, exactly like the one Rydell had worn in L.A. As a matter of fact, Rydell's was in the very duffel the guy was demanding. "Please," Rydell said, handing the bag over. Lucky Dragon security were supposed to say that. Please. It was on Mr. Park's notebook, and anyway, when you asked somebody for their bag, you were admitting you thought they might shoplift, so you might as well be polite about it. The security man narrowed his eyes. He put the bag in a numbered cubicle behind his station and handed Rydell a Lucky Dragon logo tag that looked like an oversized drink coaster with the number 5 on the back. It was the size it was, Rydell knew, because it had been determined that this size made the tags just that much too big to fit into most pockets, thereby preventing people from pocketing, forgetting, and wandering away with them. Kept costs down. Everything about Lucky Dragon was worked out that way. You sort of had to admire them. "You're welcome," Rydell said. He headed for the ATM in the back, Lucky Dragon International Bank. He knew it was watching him as he walked up to it, pulling his wallet from his back pocket. "I'm here to get a chip issued," he said.
"Identify yourself, please."
Lucky Dragon ATMs all had this same voice, a weird, uptight, strangled little castrato voice, and he wondered why that was. But you could be sure they'd worked it out. Probably it kept people from standing around bullshitting with the machine. But Rydell knew that you didn't want to do that anyway, because the suckers would pepper spray you. They were plastered with notices to that effect, too, although he doubted anyone ever actually read them. What the notices didn't say, and Lucky Dragon wasn't telling, was that if you tried seriously to dick with one, drive a crowbar into the money slot, say, the thing would mist you and itself down with water and then electrify itself. "Barry Rydell," he said, taking his Tennessee driver's license from his wallet and inserting the business end into the ATM's reader.
"Palm contact."
Rydell pressed his hand within the outline of a hand. He hated the way that felt. Bad cootie factor with those palm scan things. Hand grease. He wiped his palm on his trousers.
"Please enter your personal identification code."
Rydell did, working through his mnemonic to the two cans of 7-Up.
"Processing credit request,"
the thing said, sounding as if someone were squeezing its balls. Rydell looked around and saw that he was pretty much the only customer, aside from a woman with gray hair and black leather pants, who was giving the checker a hard time in what sounded to Rydell like German.
"Transaction completed,"
the ATM said. Rydell turned back in time to see a Lucky Dragon credit chip emerge from the chip slot. He shoved it partway back in to see the available come up on the screen. Not bad. Not bad at all. He pocketed the chip, put his wallet away, and turned toward the Globex concession, which also doubled as the local USPO. Like the ATM, this was another purpose-built node or swelling in the same plastic wall. They hadn't had one of these on Sunset, and Praise God had had to double as Globex clerk and or USPO employee, the latter causing her occasionally to frown, as her parents' sect identified all things federal as aspects of Satan. "He who hesitates," Rydell's father had taught him, "is safe," and Rydell had tried hard in the course of his life to practice that sort of benign procrastination. Just about everything that had ever landed him in deep shit, he knew, had been the result of not hesitating. There was in him, he didn't know why, that which simply went for it, and somehow at the worst possible time. Look before you leap. Consider consequences. Think about it. he thought about it. Someone had taken advantage of his brief but unwilling sojourn in Selwyn Tong's VR corridor to convey the suggestion that he should pick up his credit chip from this particular ATM and then check Globex. This could most easily have been Tong himself, speaking, as it were, through a back channel, or it might have been someone, anyone else, hacking into what Rydell supposed was scarcely a world-class secure site. The look of the change that had been wrought for Rydell's benefit, though, had had hacker written all over it. In Rydell's experience, hackers just couldn't resist showing off, and they tended to get all arty. And he knew they could get your ass in trouble, and usually did. He looked at the Globex bulge there. Went for it. It took him less time than it had to get the credit chip to show his license and get the hatch open. It was a bigger package than he'd expected, and it was heavy for its size, really heavy. Expensive-looking foam core stuff, very precisely sealed with gray plastic tape, and covered with animated Globex Maximum Express holograms, customs stickers. He studied the waybill. It had come from Tokyo, looked like, but the billing was to Paragon Asia Data Flow, which was on Lygon Street, Melbourne, Australia. Rydell didn't know anybody in Australia, but he did know that it was supposed to be impossible, and definitely was illegal, to ship anything internationally to one of these Globex pickups. They needed an address, private or business. These pickup points were only for domestic deliveries. Damn, thing was heavy. He got it under his arm, maybe 2 feet long and 6 inches on a side, and went back to get his bag. Which he saw now was open, on the little counter there, and the guard with the pale eyebrows was holding Rydell's pink Lucky Dragon fanny pack. "What are you doing with my bag?" The guard looked up. "This is Lucky Dragon property." "You aren't supposed to open people's bags," Rydell said. "Says so on the notebook." "I have to treat this as theft. You have Lucky Dragon property here." Rydell remembered that he'd put the ceramic switchblade in the fanny pack because he hadn't been able to think what else to do with it. He tried to remember whether or not that was illegal up here. It was in SoCal, he knew, but not in Oregon. "That's my property," Rydell said, "and you're going to give it to me right now." "Sorry," the man said deliberately. "Hey, Rydell," said a familiar voice as the door was opened so forcefully that Rydell distinctly heard something snap in the closing mechanism. "Some bitch, how they hanging?" Rydell was instantly engulfed in a fog of vodka and errant testosterone. He turned and saw Creedmoor grinning fiercely, quite visibly free of the human condition. Behind him loomed a larger man, pale and fleshy, his dark eyes set close together. "You're drunk," snapped the security guard. "Get out." "Drunk?" Creedmoor winced grotesquely, miming some crippling emotional pain. "Says I'm drunk." Creedmoor turned to the man behind him. "Randy, this motherfucker says I'm drunk." The corners of the large man's mouth, which was small and strangely delicate in such a heavy, stubbled face, turned instantly down, as if he were genuinely and very, very deeply saddened to learn that it was possible for one human being to treat another in so unkind a way. "So whoop his faggot ass, then," the large man suggested softly, as if the prospect held at least some wistful possibility, however distant, of cheer after great disappointment. "Drunk?" Creedmoor was facing the security man again. He leaned across the counter, his chin level with the top of Rydell's bag.
"What kind of shit you trying to lay off on my buddy here?"
Creedmoor was radiating an amphetamine reptile menace now, his anger gone right off the mammalian scale. Rydell saw a little muscle pulsing in Creedmoor's cheek, steady and involuntary as some tiny extra heart. Seeing that Creedmoor had the guard's undivided attention, Rydell grabbed his bag with one hand, the pink fanny pack with the other. The guard tried to snatch them back, which was definitely a mistake, as the attempt occupied both his hands.
"Suck my dick!"
Creedmoor shrieked, striking with far more speed and force than Rydell would have credited him with, and sank his fist wrist-deep into the guard's stomach just below the sternum. Taken by surprise, the guard doubled forward. Rydell, as Creedmore was winding back to slug the man in the face, managed to tangle Creedmore's wrist in the straps of a fanny pack, almost dropping the bulky parcel in the process.
"Come on, Buell,"
Rydell said, spinning Creedmore back out the door. Rydell knew someone would have hit a foot button by now.
"Motherfucker says I'm drunk,"
Creedmore protested. "Well, you are, Buell," said the heavy man ponderously behind them. Creedmore giggled. "Let's get out of here," Rydell said, starting for the bridge. As he walked, he was trying to stuff the fanny pack back into his duffel and trying not to lose his precarious underarm grip on the Globex package. A twisting gust of wind blew grit into his eyes, and blinking down to clear them, he noticed for the first time that the waybill was addressed not to him, but to Colin Laney. Colin Space Laney. So why had they let Rydell pick it up? Then they were in the thick of the crowd, headed up the ramp of the lower level.
"What is this shit?"
Creedmore asked, peering up. "San Francisco, Oakland Bay," Rydell said.
"Shit,"
Creedmore said, squinting at the crowd.
"Smells like a fucking bait box. Bet you could get you some weird-ass pussy out here."
"I need a drink," the heavy man with the delicate mouth said softly. "I think I do, too," said Rydell.